Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Hillary Waters Fail. Oh boy, Hillary, welcome.
Thank you so much, both of you, for inviting me to be here today.
I have shown your work to numerous people already. This is, I can't wait to learn. Wow. Embroidering on leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she says, yeah, that's what I do.
I know, I told that to my daughter, and she was just like, what, you're going to, and I showed her pictures. She's like, oh, I'm so jealous you're going to talk to her. So,
aww.
I'm excited. This is fabulous.
Yep, I'm Hillary. Yeah. I do embroidery, but it is a normal. Okay.
Unexpected.
Yeah. All right, so we got a first question out of the gate here. You're assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth and head of the fiber area in the craft material studies. Now, that seems mm-hmm. like a real niche-y portion of a university.
It's like, yeah, it's like a, you know, a fraction of a slice of a piece of cake.
Okay, okay.
It definitely is, you know, very specified. But I think, you know, I have a degree from Buffalo State College in fiber design. And then I actually am sort of an anomaly in that I'm now teaching at and running the program that I went through for grad school. So I went to Virginia Commonwealth University for my MFA, and I graduated and I kind of hung around afterwards. And
one of those students.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I worked for a different department for a couple of years, and then I, you know, left and moved to North Carolina, and then I came back. And so it just so happened that someone who had this job, you know, so basically what this job is teaching all of the, or a majority of the classes in the fiber area, and then the Department of Craft and Material Studies is kind of an amazing little corner of the world, because it's there are five different areas. So fiber, metal, and jewelry, wood and furniture, ceramics, you know, clay, and then glass. So we have all of wow. those five areas covered within the Department of Craft and Material Studies. Right. And so it's like almost like five mini departments. And so I'm just kind of running the fiber area. So that means taking care of the studios and, you know, the monitors and the adjuncts and the graduate teaching assistants. And I teach the grads there. I'm in charge of that. And then I also teach undergrad classes in fiber. So that's kind of like, that's kind of the gist of it, I guess.
Well, I did not know this existed, because, you know, when you think about, I'd like to get an education, a formal education in some kind of fiber art, textiles, or any of those things, you know, you think about having to go like to the Royal School of Needlework or something to get that mm-hmm. education. But you have the full package right there. I assume you draw a number of students.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about Virginia Commonwealth University is that it's also a state school, which makes it really affordable. And it's part of like VCU Arts. So the School of the Arts is much larger and has 16 departments, and craft material studies is just one of them. But it is kind of specialized. You know, there aren't that many programs in the country where you can go and get a degree specifically in craft and material studies. And so I do feel like really fortunate to be a part of it, because it's such a special thing, I think, to be able to take these really traditional ways of making and knowing in the world and to be able to pass them on to future generations and, you know, take what we did know and put it forth to, you know, what we know now, and people can kind of take those things and say something different, tell their story with these techniques and processes.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. And I feel, like I said, so fortunate to be a part of it.
Well, yeah, it's just so neat that this exists, that there's this outlet for people who want to grow with their art. Wow, mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you win.
Yeah.
And then for you as an artist, it's kind of the perfect job then, right? Because it kind of gives you an environment where you can develop and grow your own work.
Yeah, I would definitely say, I mean, I would say that education has always been a really big part of my life and certainly influences my studio practice. And it's definitely not ideal in some ways, just because of the amount of time that it takes, you know, like when you're, you know, right. taking care of the weaving studio and the service design studio and ordering all the supplies and sending late night emails to students who are worried about their projects and, you know, making sure that everyone's got what they need. It is a lot. It's a huge job. And so that does unfortunately take a big chunk of my time away from the studio. So that balance of, you know, how much of my time gets split off for students and how much gets, you know, split off for stitching, saved for stitching. It's like sometimes the opposite of what I would like.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah. Now that, you know, people who have I'll use the word hobby, but have a hobby that is related to their paying job. Sometimes the hobby is, get me home because it's a good release. And sometimes it gets set aside and eventually fades away because it's, I've had enough of that today and I need to get on to something different. I assume for you, it's a release. It's an outlet and a way to reorient yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really look forward to getting to sit down in my studio and actually work, not on my computer.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Sit and stitch, you know, right. And I think my job is different enough. Every day I'm either teaching and teaching stitching. Embroidery is only part of what I teach. You know, it's like the whole range of felting and spinning and, crochet and knit, and then, you know, this is an intro class, let's say. So then we do actually get to do a little bit of embroidery, but then we move on to sewing and quilting. So there's, you know, this big range of what I'm doing and talking about and thinking about. So it does generally feel like a real treat and a relief to come home and to be able to sit down and start working on something. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm quitting my job. I'm coming. I'm going back to school. I'm just going back to school.
Yeah, you should. Come on.
Do you find interacting with the students sometimes spurs on your own creativity, though?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So that was the other part of what I was going to say, was that, you know, it does definitely impact my life. And I think so. You know, seeing students get really excited about different fiber and textile processes is like, there is nothing better. That's, you know, that's heaven for a fiber nerd right there. But I have to say, the cool thing, one of the best things about this job is that I learn things all the time. And there are always, you know, grad students coming in and adjuncts coming in who are coming from, you know, different backgrounds, different parts of the country or the world, and have just like this different knowledge than I have. And so I feel like I get to learn things all the time, and someone will read a book and then they'll bring it in and they'll say, you should read this book. And it's the best, you know, it's this constant influx of just different ideas and different things that you wouldn't necessarily find on your own. So I do feel just so lucky to be in that environment where people are really excited and there's this real dialogue, you know, around these processes and these arts.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah, that didn't occur to me, but yeah, you get to be really in a melting pot of cultures and but yeah, that can be huge for an artist to get all kinds of influences from all, you know, ethnic backgrounds and historical backgrounds. Oh boy, what fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. It is the best.
Good for you. That's great. So, all right, now making a living, you obviously have your studio and art business. Your paying job is embroidery, textiles, craft, art, all of those things. Something you started doing early in life, or is the embroidery and the and this art a more recent thing?
No, I mean, it's always kind of been my path, I guess, since college, you know, when I went to college for fiber design. But even getting to that point, I would say I was kind of unsure. So I guess maybe I'll just tell you a little bit about, you know, my earlier story. And I think we all do what we do because we have a story. And so I'll just tell you my story. But I was... when I was a little kid, I did teach myself to stitch, and probably not incredibly well, but I always wanted to make things. I remember just, you know, wanting very badly to whittle something with a knife. And I think my parents were not really into the idea of giving me a knife. And so, you know, a thread and needle are very accessible and very easy to get my hands on. And so that's kind of where I started. And it was this opportunity to work with a material and make something out of very little. So you could add stitching to a dress or a pillow or, you know, something, and it would totally shift the way I felt about that thing because I had altered it in some way. And, it was easy to do and I didn't need very much, you know, just a thread and needle. And so I kind of had this real love for stitching early on, but I wouldn't have necessarily like related that to, okay, this is my trajectory in life now.
Yeah.
It was just something that I enjoyed. And so my family was very supportive of me as an artist at a young age. And I, you know, went to the art gallery all the time and loved drawing and painting, but that was just, again, in my mind, a thing I did for fun. And then the other kind of part of my life at that point was like being a wild child outside and building forts in the woods and learning about the birds and learning about nature. And I was very, very into that. And I actually was able to attend a summer camp when I was 14 that was centered around this idea of teaching kids about nature and how to be stewards of the land and just the ecosystem of upstate New York, which is where I grew up. So I went there, I fell in love completely. And it sounds silly to say this, but I didn't actually realize that people devoted their entire life to like protecting the land. And so that kind of opened my eyes to that idea. And after that experience, I was really torn and kind of like, well, maybe environmental science is something that I would really like to pursue, or, you know, biology, or, you know, I don't know, but maybe that's the path for me. And so I kind of was torn all the way up through high school and to the point where I needed to choose where I was going to go to college, which in hindsight, you know, sounds so silly because I definitely could have done both. But, you know, being a silly 18-year-old, you don't know what you want. And it just seems like you have to make a choice. And so at that point, you know, I just didn't, I got a really wonderful scholarship to Buffalo State College. And that was very close to where my parents lived. And so I was not happy about it. You know, and I wanted to go far away. And of course, I was totally a brat. And just didn't, I was kind of like crossing my arms and having that teenage angst and I didn't sign up for classes until the day before school started. And the only thing that was left, were classes in fiber and textile design. So that's what I did. And it's just, it's like kind of fell into my lap. I know it sounds like ridiculous to say that, but sometimes
no it doesn't.
Like the world unfolds as it should.
I have college age students, and yes, I totally can relate to that 18-year-old angst and waiting to the last minute. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, it was. I mean, you know, I look back and I'm like, gosh, I'm really lucky that things worked out the way they did. And I did not do anything to help myself. But thank goodness. So I went, you know, I went through that program and I made a bunch of garbage work that was not very good. And I just didn't kind of, you know, it was like dyeing things and weaving things. And I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't anything that like I felt amazing about. And so I went, I actually had the opportunity to go while I was in college, my junior year, and study in Manchester. So Manchester Metropolitan University has a specific embroidery degree. So you can go just for embroidery. And I did that and I didn't know what to expect. And it just totally shifted the way that I felt about what I was doing and the discipline that I had, you know, as far as what I was doing in my studio, in the studio. And that experience just totally changed me and changed the way I looked at my work, which I'm just so grateful for. And I, you know, I now have the opportunity to teach a study abroad class, and it's awesome to be able to kind of complete that circle and give back some of that experience that I had. But I fell in love with stitching in a real hard way, hard love. while I was there, I got really into insertion stitching and these kind of like needle lace joining stitches, which, you know, looking back on that work now feels so clumsy. But at the time I was like this, you know, I did love it. I do love it still. Not only because it's just very complex and tiny and I love that kind of work, but also just this idea of joining two things together and the sort of conceptual opening that created. And so that kind of was what I was doing. And I came back from that experience. So that ended in May, you know, as the term does. And I came back and I had a job at the camp that I went to as a kid. So the, you know, nature camp, I am the cook.
Oh boy.
I had a lot of time in between meals to do whatever I wanted to do. And that was stitching. So I was kind of one day kind of casting around the kitchen, looking for something to stitch on. I had been stitching on things that I found in the UK while I was there. So I was like I did a whole project on laundry. So it was like clothing tags and the things that fall behind the dryer. So whatever that was, I would pull them out and stitch them.
Oh, jeez.
I love it.
Which, you know, there were some good things behind the dryer, let me tell you, but lots of socks and just little odds and ends and bits. But so I didn't have anything with me to stitch onto. And I was like, what could I stitch? And I went outside and there was just this beautiful oak tree there. And I just thought, well, maybe I'll stitch on a leaf. And see what happens. And
so it was that random. It was literally that random. Oh,
it was literally that random, but it made so much sense. Again, it was like, as soon as I did it, I had this, it sounds so dumb, but it was like the light bulb, you know, it was like, oh, like this is how I connect these two things that have been so important to me and throughout my life. Like, this is how I talk about what I really care about talking about, which is, you know, being in balance in the way that we sort of relate to the natural world and the land, and thinking about that a little bit more carefully, and stitching, and, you know, these traditions, these ways of working with our hands and knowing the world through working with our hands. And so the joining stitches that I was using at that point were like literally joining these two things together. And I just, that was the first thing that I ever made that I felt really, really proud of. So that was kind of the start of it all.
So all of this wandering around and trying things and haphazardly just poking away at things all comes together while you're a cook at this camp.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. It's kind of amazing when I think back on it.
Yeah, it is. Well, I have to say, you just gave me an incredible idea. You just gave me an excellent idea. My sister just started. She was a special ed teacher, and she burned herself out. And she just started this year teaching at a school in Michigan where just about all the education happens outdoors year round.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and she is just eating it up because she's an outdoors person. And she's just eating it up. So they're out in nature. I mean, classes, everything happen outdoors. And I said, well, what about winter in Michigan? She says, we layer up. You just layer up and go do it. You know, build a fire to warm your hands and you go do it. And it just struck me. And she's in charge of developing her curriculum. And what you do, I gotta show her now, because this could be another part of what her curriculum is this very kind of thing. Oh boy. Wow. What fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it is fun. I mean, it's fun and it's amazing to get to just, you know, do the things that I love doing and talk about what I want to talk about. And
so your maturity moment then happened in Manchester. That's when you started to straighten up.
Yeah, that's
and fly
when I
right.
stopped being an angsty teenager, I think.
We all have that moment.
Thank you. Yep.
Yes, all of us. Oh.
All right. So you're this cook and you, all right, now leaves and embroidering on leaves. Now, does that then start to form a path for you where you can express your art and off you go?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think at that point, you know, like I said, I kind of had this realization that this resonates with me. You know, this, what I'm doing right here is resonating and nothing has really felt that way before. So I'm going to keep doing it. And I, you know, I did keep doing it and I kind of, the more I did it and the more, you know, as we all know, the longer you sit and stitch things, you have a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about what I'm doing and it makes sense. You know, it makes sense to me that kind of everything that I have done since then has been under this umbrella of, talking about, you know, our connection or the connection between nature and the land and the human hand. And the types of relationships that we have and the ways in which, you know, we can do incredible things and work really harmoniously when we're careful and thoughtful.
Yes. So take us through, you've got so many forms of art that you do that we got to talk about these things. So take us through the process of, and it must have been a long learning curve of selecting, preparing and stitching on leaves so they just don't become a bunch of crumbs in your hand.
Yeah. So I'll say that deciduous leaves and the leaves that, you know, are meant to really only stick around for one season typically are a lot more difficult to work with. They're just not as tough or thick as some of the leaves that you might find a little bit further south, like rhododendrons and magnolias and camellias and ligustrum, you know, these types of leaves that have they're a little bit tougher and have like a waxy coating almost. And that really is probably the easiest thing to work with. But at the point where I was learning, I kind of started out by, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. You know, I just was experimenting and trying to figure it out. And so I would just get all kinds of leaves and I would try to work on them fresh. Or if that didn't really work, I would try to press them and see if that worked any better. I went out to visit a friend of mine in California. And at that point, we took a hike and there were bay leaves and eucalyptus leaves. And that really got me thinking like, okay, so some of these leaves are much, much easier for me to work on. So I need to think about, you know, the type of leaf that I'm working on. And I started trying to put a coating on some of them. And so some of those really early pieces, that I'm sure there's still images floating around. You can almost see this shiny sheen coating on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I didn't really know what I was totally doing at that point. And I put on, you know, just like a clear fixative. But then if you put, you know, I realized that if I put it on before I stitched, then if I was like, it would puncture and it would pop through if it was on the surface and you would see that it had a coating on it. And I really didn't like that. And so I realized that I just want to work with them as purely as possible, you know, just the leaf whenever possible. And that's most of the time what I do.
In doing this, you're alone in the world, right? I mean, you've got nobody you can call or write to and say, hey, how are you pulling this off? You're literally hanging out there by yourself figuring it out.
That I've seen two other people, and it was, you know, like after when I started doing this, there was not Instagram, there was not, you know, social media in the capacity that we have it today. And so I did at that point like a whole bunch of Google searching just to see, like, did I make this up? Is someone else doing this?
Is anyone out there?
Is anyone out there? So now I know that there are two other people. There's a woman in South America who primarily stitches birds onto leaves. And then there's Susanna Bauer, who does a lot of crochet embroidery around the edges of leaves. And her work is really beautiful and lovely, but a little bit different than mine. And so, yeah, there's not really a community of people doing this. So I kind of did figure out a lot of things on my own, and that's fine. Cause you know,
I think we got to start a new organization, the Leaf Embroiderers Guild of the World.
That's right. Yep.
So the science of just simply figuring out what leaves to work with was a huge hurdle.
It was fun, you know,
yeah.
And certainly I broke a lot of leaves in the beginning and didn't, you know, it's like, it is what it is, but then you can just put it in the compost pile and it goes away,
right.
It goes back to the earth and it's fine, which is an aspect of this that I love. But yeah, trying to figure out how to work with really fragile leaves, anything deciduous or flower petals, or when to work with something when it was fresh versus pressed. All of that was kind of discoveries that keep it interesting. I'll say that.
As you're doing that, so when you start to go like California and you start to see other leaves, then is it now off to the botanic garden or whatever to see just what's available? And a lot of experimenting, or do you find a couple of leaves that work and then lock in on the embroidery?
I mean, I have found, certainly, you know, I do collect leaves where I go, if I go somewhere, and I try to, you know, if I'm going to a botanical garden or something, I try to get permission, or even the parks around here, I try to get permission just so that, you know, people don't feel like I'm coming and fruiting things, but I definitely try to be really respectful to the plants that I'm taking from and just, you know, be a good plant ally also and think about when it is in the season for that plant and what I'm taking. You know, is it a fresh leaf? Is it a leaf that's been around for a couple years and is going to be let go? Have I taken too many from this one plant? So I just, you know, I try to be really careful about that. But more often than not, I'm just walking around my neighborhood and, you know, taking a leaf from this tree and a leaf from that tree and something from this bush or whatever. And that's great because, again, it's like I love accessibility. I love the ease of just being able to do that. But absolutely, there are special leaves and there's still, I mean, I've barely scratched the surface.
Yeah.
So... lots more to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I got to believe that tropical leaves, I mean, so many of them are just gigantic that to be able to, yeah, to latch on and experiment with some of those too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm thinking mm-hmm. of places I've been in the South and what leaves. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to go somewhere, you know, at some point and do an artist residency somewhere tropical where there's, you know, lots of jungly leaves and plants and just the difference in the diversity of plant life in different areas is incredible. And I would love to do that at some point. I have enough on my plate right now.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I would think that would too, would also, you know, going to a different country, you know, where it's tropical or something would also influence your art too. I think it would influence what you actually did on your leaves.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge inspiration for me is just, you know, textiles and the patterns and designs that are wherever I am. And I look at them all the time, partially because of my job, but also partially because that's what I'm interested in. You know, I love looking through historical textiles and just textiles from around the world and pattern design, you know, tiles and wallpaper and, you know, just different, mm-hmm. different, you know, from different eras and different places. So
all right. So you find a leaf that works. Mm-hmm. And then now we have to determine needle and thread. That had to be yet another level of experimentation.
Yeah. And this is embarrassing to admit, but it took me a really long time to realize that the needles that I was working with were way too big. So I, as you might not be surprised, I'm just a huge fan of working with what you have. And so I have a ton of thread that people have given me, which I do use all the time. And, you know, needles, just regular needles of all different sizes. And it took me, you know, quite a while to realize that I need to be working with a needle that's really, really, really small. Mm-hmm. And so I use size 12 betweens.
Whoa,
which are,
it's just a little wire.
They're tiny. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're teeny tiny. And they're just a little bit thicker than a beading needle. But the beading needles they're too flexible. For what I want. So, so that is what I use. And with those needles, I'll use, typically one or two strands of, DMC thread most of the time. You know, sometimes I'm working with specialty metallic thread or just thread. I have a lot of hand dyed thread as well. That's really beautiful, but trying to get two of the DMC threads through the hole of a size 12 between is like, I swear it's the hardest part of the whole thing. So I have a pin cushion full of like 20 or 25 needles that just have, you know, all of the colors that I've been using recently that I just intentionally thread way too long of a thread through them because it takes me so darn long to get them threaded. So I just leave them threaded.
Right.
Jeez. I am really surprised that you're using DMC. I thought you were going to give us some ultra thin thread.
No. Well, you know, I do, when I'm couching, you know, you don't always want to be able to build up a surface or you want to be able to, you know, with what I'm doing too, the fewer holes I can puncture, the better. So if the thread has a little bit more of body and thickness to it, then that's kind of better. Which is why I use the two strands, but sometimes I will use a really fine metallic thread or just a regular sewing thread, which is a little bit visually thinner than a single strand of DMC.
Talk about leaf prep. You have to do anything to them? Depends on the leaf before you can stitch so that they don't come all apart. Obviously, you hold them in hand. How do you a great, must be a slow process to make sure you don't crack the leaf.
Oh, it definitely is. Like I said, sometimes I press the leaves first and sometimes I don't. It just depends on the leaf. And then some leaves and flower petals and such that are really, really fragile, I'll put like a skin on the back of an archival bookbinding glue, and that will just help to maintain, you know, some sort of body for the needle to push through and not just totally crumble. So that helps. But I mean, it's not like it's, you're adding a piece of iron to the back of your leaf. It's definitely going to break. So, and the saddest thing is, I have to say, yes, and holding them in hand, obviously no hoop. So they do, I mean, the silly thing is that sometimes more frequently now than, you know, accidentally cracking it with a thread or the needle, it's my own clothing or, you know, something that I'm wearing that just gets caught in what I'm doing. And that has happened a couple times, and it just feels like incredibly stupid that that's how I broke something, but it happens.
So, all right. So then obviously care all the way along as you're stitching, but then as you get more advanced with the current design, you're really being careful you don't break that leaf, because then everything's lost.
Exactly. Yeah. You really can't recover.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Does the leaf dictate the design, or do you have a design and then look for a leaf that will be the best ground cloth, if you will, for it? How does that exchange work?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, I tend to, if I save leaves, I'm a leaf, you know, I have tons of leaves pressed and just dried, ready to work with. Sometimes I have commissions, and so I know ahead of the time that I want to work with a particular type of leaf because it's going to be the best for this type of design I need to do. Or the person who I'm making the piece for will say, you know, this particular tree is really special to me for any number of reasons, right? I think that's kind of at the heart of what I'm doing, is thinking about the connections that we have to the plants and to the land, and how plants can be such an indicator of place and of memory and of home, and of people, right? So sometimes the leaf itself will be very special, and that will need to be what gets used. And so that'll kind of dictate what happens. And in that case, you know, in the case where I'm just using the leaf for the leaf itself, I really do try to pay attention to what's happening in the leaf, you know, what is going on, and how can I just contribute to what's happening with the leaf, but not necessarily overpower it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a conversation I try to have with what I'm doing, and just collaborate, I guess.
With the leaf, yes. No, I can see. No, but I can see how that the leaf shape and the veins and color would speak to you and say, no, it's this thread and it's this embroidery pattern that is going to complement it or make it better, if you will. I can see how that could be going on in your head. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So then the other thing you do with leaves, which equally fascinates me, is cutting them, X-Acto knife. What made you go and do that? The PETA people are freaking out right now because you're tearing up leaves, but whatever.
Well, I was always really interested in paper cutting, you know, so I do have these, like, I look at other things, like I said, like other patterns, other craft traditions, and paper cutting is something that I always found really, really incredible. And so I was working on paper cuts for a while. And then I just kind of thought simultaneously, you know, as I was also working with leaves and in stitching, and I just kind of thought maybe I could also cut the leaves. You know, that seems like something you could do. And so, of course, it does, you know, certain leaves lend themselves really well and really beautifully to that. And so that's something that I really love doing. And it's really, surprisingly a lot faster than stitching, or maybe not surprisingly, but it's really, it's quick to do something, you know, that's really graphic and you can see something totally different. So it's like a, you know, a reductive process instead of an additive process. And so it's kind of the opposite, but working with both is, I don't know, it's like another brain thing that I really love the way that feels. It's like sometimes you're taking material away and sometimes you're adding it, and just having those things kind of going on simultaneously keeps everything feeling like exciting and fresh, I think.
All right. So do you start with a pattern when you do your cutting?
That's a good question. I don't always, I pretty much always do sketch something out. I'm drawing is a big part of my practice, and I'll draw something in my sketchbook that I might want to cut or stitch. And then depending on the complexity, I might give myself some guides on the back of the leaf. And what I do, what I use for that is, it's that varies depending on the leaf, but I really love the fabric markers that go, you know, they disappear with moisture. So those I tend to use a lot, but they're not appropriate for every leaf. So sometimes there's not really a great way to transfer a design with like a writing utensil. And so I will, this process is a little bit arduous, even talking about it, but like I'll transfer the design out of my sketchbook onto a piece of tracing paper, and then I'll put that over the top of the leaf, and then I'll prick the whole design like you would prick and pounce with like a chalk onto fabric, but there's no pouncing. So it's just the pricking, and that's enough to give me a guide and an outline for where I want to cut or stitch.
So basically a perforation that you then cut. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I love that you're figuring all this stuff out, you know, as you go. Yeah. There's no kit to buy at a store. Yeah.
No. Right. I mean, I figured that out because I really wanted to start doing black work, or counted, you know, any kind of counted thread work. But when there's no count threads to count, you have to come up with a grid somehow. And so that kind of pushed me to figure out how to work with a grid on something that doesn't have a grid inherently.
Yeah. So it's disappointing to me that deciduous leaves are not a good ground cloth, because you would think that particularly in the fall that you'd just love to latch onto the reds and the oranges and yellows and use those, but just generally don't hold up well enough to do these kinds of things.
You know, I won't say that they don't. They just are much more fragile and a little bit more difficult to work with.
Okay.
And they tend not to, you know, they'll hold their color to some extent, but it always shifts. You know, the color always shifts, and that's definitely part of the piece. It's part of the work, is that it's organic and it will have life. It does have a life.
Yeah.
You know, continuing its life, but just in a little bit of a slowed down capacity, I guess. But that shift in color is something that I try to anticipate, or at least think about when I'm going to choose the colors that I'm working with. But yeah, the deciduous leaves are gorgeous, and some of them, I have used lots of them, but they're not the easiest.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'll just say that.
Now, when it comes to a finished piece, and then you want to frame it, put it in a box or something, do you have to do something to the finished piece to make sure it holds up over time? Or does that happen just because of what you selected when you did it, when you put it together?
No, that's definitely. So when I'm, you know, if I press them ahead of time, they're pressed. And if I haven't done that, then I will press them as I'm working on them and afterwards. And so the idea with pressing a leaf is that you're allowing the moisture to leave at an even rate, and that's going to stop it. And it's also under tension and pressure. So that's going to kind of stop it from wanting to curl up as much as it dries out. And it should just hold that position. And there are specimens in herbariums that are hundreds of years old, but certainly they're, you know, incredibly well preserved and in the exact right conditions. So what I'm doing is, you know, a couple steps down from that for sure. So I'm just pressing them, making sure all the moisture is gone, trying to make sure as much as possible that there's no insects or insect larvae that could come back and wreak havoc in the future.
Yeah.
And then they're framed, you know, on archival materials and behind museum glass. So they're protected from, to the extent, you know, to the best extent, they're protected from UV light and air and moisture. They'll break down eventually. I think it'll probably be after, they'll last longer than I will.
Okay.
But yeah, they're not going to be around forever and ever.
Now, did I?
And that's okay.
Yeah. Did I see, examples of your art where you combine cutting and embroidery in a leaf, or am I making that up? Okay.
No. There's a couple of those. There's a couple of those, definitely. And it's not something that I decided to stop doing. It just, I think I did some, and it at the time wasn't as interesting to me, so I just moved on. But it's definitely something I would go back to in the future.
Yeah, interesting. Other challenge. All right, now another part of your art, and I can't determine which part blows me away the most, but the work that you do with snake scales from skin that has been shed, molting, and then taking feathers apart and using those to do line art. Number one, it's the vision. I struggle to relate to people like you who can see the art in those things and see the opportunity to create art. So that's not me. And so, you know, I just admire that to no end, that you can just pick that stuff up and say, all right, this can be something else. How do those two come into play? Just walking around looking for leaves and you see a feather and say, hey, let me see what I can do with this.
I mean, to some extent, yeah, but I also have always, you know, in my life, kind of like being outside and just looking at things closely, I have a large collection of feathers that I've found. And, you know, they're just the objects that you pick up have some kind of, you know, there's a reason that you pick them up, right? You find them beautiful or meaningful or interesting or something. And so, kind of just thinking about the inherent meaning in material and what the material can do and what it can say is something that I do think about a lot. And I started doing that, actually. It's a little bit of a story also, but I had a friend who passed away and my grandmother passed away, right? Very close to each other. And so in the wake of that, I kind of, it's like, just, I had no idea what to do. I was totally devastated. And I didn't really feel like doing any artwork. You know, I just didn't, I wasn't sure what the point of it all was. And so I was out running on Christmas morning, actually. And this was in Buffalo. And it was snow, you know, beautiful, crisp, fresh snow. And as I was running, there was a dead cardinal right in front of me on the path. And, you know, and you can imagine, like, it's just so striking, you know, this white snow and then just this bright red male cardinal on the ground. And it felt like some kind of gift. And that's, you know, I just felt like I needed to pay attention to that. And so I picked it up and ran back with it. And my mom was, you know, like, you did what?
Your poor parents.
You want to put that
poor
where?
Parents, an entire year with this daughter.
I know.
From the day she was born, you know, she has just been, oh.
Yeah, asking for knives and bringing home dead birds. there's a saying about cardinals, you know, and it's just one of those things that, you know, people say, but that when you see a cardinal, it's someone who has passed away saying hello. And so that was so on my mind at that moment. And I was, you know, just like, oh my gosh, this is what this is. So I've never in my life of, you know, watching birds, paying attention to birds, going on hikes, seen a dead cardinal. And I saw one. And then a month later, I was taking someone to the airport. And there was another one right on the side of the airport road. And I was like, holy moly, this is something. This is like, in these moments, it just feels like something. And so I had these two cardinals and I just thought, okay, I have to use them in some way that feels meaningful. And I was just thinking about, when someone passes away, we have the memories, we have the feeling of them, but we don't have them anymore. And so it's this transition of something that was into, you know, they're still there, they're still with us, but it's unrecognizable as far as the physicality goes. And so I was thinking about that a lot as I was taking these feathers and pulling out every single thread on the feather and gluing it back down. So like everything is still there, but it's just arranged in this way that feels totally different. And, you know, the circle, I use these kind of never ending circles a lot in those pieces. And that was definitely a meditation on, you know, just life and death and the continuation of energy and, you know, the years and the orbits around the sun and all the things, seasons. And so that's kind of what those pieces were about. And the snake scales came a little bit after the feathers. I started using snake scales instead of feathers because, you know, it was, I should have known better, but of course there's the Migratory Bird Act, which prohibits using any type of feathers of birds that are protected under the act, which are pretty much every bird that you would find here, except for, you know, European starlings and game birds, game fowl. And so all of those works that I've done with the feathers that are anything but chicken feathers, I shouldn't have done them basically. Oh. So it's just like, okay, I'm going to move on from that and because I don't want to be promoting, you know, using these materials in a way that is, you know, right. I'd rather use something that, so I started using the snake scales, which, you know, again, I have snake skins from just finding them and picking them up, and then people send them to me and people save them for me. And so I have a lot of snake skins. And I kind of, you know, they have their own kind of meanings and their own kind of symbolisms and ideas that go along with snakes, which I love. I love, you know, that idea of transition and shedding your skin and moving forward and changing and becoming a new version of yourself. And also just thinking about what you leave behind when you do that. And, you know, this continual kind of idea of rebirth so I love the snake scales, but that's, you know, very much the same process of having a snake skin and with jeweler's tweezers, pulling every scale off and dipping it into glue and then gluing it back down to paper.
Hmm. The community of people you've created, starting with your parents, of people who support you with by sending you snake skins and other things. What are you sending that? Who is this you're sending this to?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Truly, truly amazing. And I got this. That last year, someone sent me this incredible box. I mean, she just wrote to me and she said, I'm downsizing, you know, my house, but I've had a lifetime of walking through the woods and finding treasures. And you seem like a person who should have them. And so she just sent me this box full of feathers and snake skins and strange leaves and insect parts and just, you know, bits of fur and just like curious nature treasures that, yeah, I was like, this is incredible. What an incredible thing to be connected to people you know, through the materials that I'm using.
As you're talking there and I'm thinking about your parents, you know, that has to, I get a sense, supportive, understanding parents that bring you up in an environment that allows your mind to work like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so lucky. Yeah. My parents and my grandparents, you know, and my whole family really has just been incredibly supportive and encouraging. And yeah, I do feel incredibly lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. We see that in a lot of artists where it's that foundation, that family foundation of, if nothing else, understanding, but support and providing opportunity that plays such a significant role in the success. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, another piece of art in this long list of your of your forms of art is your blueprints. And then you have the wall mural installation. Where is that at? Talk about all that and how that came to be.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So the blueprints, they are cyanotype prints. So that is the first way of creating a copy of something, a blueprint, before there were copy machines or anything like that. And that involves coating paper or fabric with a combination of two different iron salts that become sensitive to UV light. And so when, you know, you put something in front of them, in front of the paper, it's going to create a shadow. And wherever the shadow is, the light does not touch. And that chemical will wash right away. So it doesn't really bond with the paper unless it's hit by the rays of the sun. And so when I'm using this process, I'm using it in conjunction with botanical material that I'm, you know, going out and collecting, usually from one specific area. And I'm making these almost mandala like forms, again, that circle that I use, you know, a lot in my work, but thinking about, you know, almost creating like a thumbprint for this, you know, all of the plants and everything that's growing in this one area. And so when I'm doing this, I'm not being, you know, it's trees, it's weeds, it's anything that's in the garden, it's flowers, it's parts of flowers, anything that is there is what I'm collecting. And then all of that gets pressed and laid out in this pattern. And I try to, when I'm doing that, I, you know, kind of generally lay out the pattern and then I'll glue part of it down and then I'll go back in and add more. And then I'll glue that down and then I'll go back in and add more. And I'm gluing it down to a piece of clear acrylic. So just kind of like plexiglass. And that to me is sort of talking about, you know, like these, you know, the way that everything fits together is sort of a metaphor almost for, you know, the complexity of the ecosystem and the biomes and, you know, just the interconnectivity between everything. And so once I finish that portion, you know, the pressing and the laying everything down on this plexiglass, this acrylic, then I'm ready to go ahead and print it. So I'll take that and I will lay that right down on the paper that has been coated with those iron salts. And that will kind of create a blueprint of, you know, whatever it is that I'm printing. So it's this mandala, like, you know, fingerprint of this one area or one garden or, you know, cemetery, whatever it is. And what I love about this process is that the entire thing is powered by the sun. You know, it's like the printing process itself wouldn't be possible without sunlight. And the paper is cotton, and that is obviously, you know, coming from cotton plants that are grown outside in the sun. And the plant material that I'm using is, you know, nourished by the sun. And so all of it is, it's like, again, this idea of connectivity and just everything being connected through plants in the land. And so that's, you know, something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. And that has also been part of these larger, I guess, kind of what's influenced these larger scale public arts projects that I've been doing and thinking about, which that mural that you mentioned is one of them. And that's in Buffalo, New York. So that was a project that I did a couple years ago before the pandemic. And it was during the garden walk. So the great thing was that everyone got to participate. So you could come up and make a print for yourself and make a print for me. And people were printing things from their gardens. They were printing things from just the area where we were doing this outside. And then we had lots of different, you know, plants there for them to choose as well, that were native and non-native, and just, you know, this idea of a garden and how that sort of can also be a metaphor for community and city. And we did it in a couple different locations, and one of the locations really was in, it was right near where the mural actually is, and there's a really diverse community there. And so that was lovely because, you know, the plant that people were using were really different, and they were, you know, kind of speaking to the different places that the community there is from. And so, you know, all of these different references to home and to food all through the plant life that's being represented in that mural. So that being said, all of those prints were culminated and then arranged into this kind of grid-like structure, which to me kind of references quilts too. So that's the mural, and that's kind of something that I've been thinking about alongside, you know, the textile work. And I would still say, you know, it's very much under the umbrella of thinking about our relationship to the land and to plants, even though it's very different than the embroidery.
And I see those, and I think the blueprints, and I see them as a place to add a layer of embroidery on top.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I just want to reach into my tablet and pull that blueprint out and like and start stitching.
I know. I know. I need there to be like 4 more hours in every day.
Yes. Because yeah, they're just beautiful. The blue and white are so, it's such a striking color combination, and even just adding more white on top of those leaves to accentuate them, not adding more color to it, but just
texture.
Adding to the shapes.
Yeah. Yep. Yes. Yep, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm just going to add that to my list.
Yeah. Oh, I was like, oh, and it's
so
winter now, so
do.
I can't sun print.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep.
Beautiful. Just beautiful.
Thank you.
Hillary, this has been a blast. Thank you for doing this.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for doing this with me. This was so great to talk to you.
It was fun.
A lot of fun.
Hillary will be with us Wednesday on the Stitch Hour. And she will show us some of her work, and then we'll be able to ask questions, and she'll talk about how it got put together and what, basically how it got put together. So we'll have photos up Wednesday on the Stitch Hour at 8:00 Eastern time. And so join us for that and bring your questions, and Hillary will be with us and take us through some of these pieces of art so we can get a better appreciation for what she does. So appreciate that too. Thank you, Hillary.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be really fun.
Yep. All right. And thanks to everybody for listening.